And we're back here on Unusual Sources, broadcasting live to Hamilton at 93.3 CFMU FM and also to the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And our online service has taken special prominence today. Due to some technical glitches with the on-air system, you may have intermittent broadcast from us, but there's nothing to worry about. If you can catch us online, you can get the full uninterrupted stream at cfmu.mcmaster.ca, and the program should be live and archived for you as well. So we are unstoppable. My guest today, Anisa Mirza, is also unstoppable. I was going to conduct a phone interview with her today, but we realized that the phone system is a bit difficult to handle today. So she actually came all the way in here on her own time to be live with us in studio, and it's good to have your crystal clear voice with us today. Thanks, Anisa.
Well, thank you for having me, Brendan. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Yes, some of our more regular guests may remember Anisa. She is a senior advisor for McMaster Muslims for Peace and Justice. She's a community activist and someone who organizes professional events here in Hamilton, some of which we may have seen. We're going to be talking about some of those events later in the program today. So she's been here. She's a consultant on social justice activities in Hamilton and also in the Muslim community. So I was just saying earlier, we're going to mention some of the upcoming events. A lot of exciting things happening right now, but also some disturbing things and some things that community members have to respond to. I know earlier in the month, we heard from our esteemed Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, and he's someone who has to present a vision for Canadians, how we should define our society and where to go forward. And what he told us was that the biggest problem facing Canadians today, the biggest threat is Islam, radical Islam, and he came up with some terms like Islamicism that we're going to talk
about.
That
our Prime Minister himself coined. And it's a really alarming point, as you say, Brendan. We live in a time where exciting things are happening. We have exciting events lined up. We have more awareness than ever before. Social justice movements are growing. Youth are responding to the movements. People from various backgrounds, various ethnicities, religious associations, affiliations are coming on board and are standing up for causes that are important both locally, nationally, and internationally. At the same time, though, we have, you know, the forces within that are still trying to hold us many steps back. And it's very embarrassing that our very own Prime Minister for Canada would say such comments about, you know, Islamicism being the biggest threat to Canada and at a broader level, North America. And, you know, this term Islamicism, of course, he goes back and later explains what he really meant, extremist Islamist. But, you know, it's very interesting to me. I would think that the 10th anniversary of 9/11 would be a time to reflect on how to build more inclusive society, to help make sure we're strengthening those connections, to make sure that we don't fall into another alienation attack on an entire peoples, you know, just by the attacks or incidents of a few numbers of individuals. And Stephen Harper's comment goes right into creating demonization. His language, and whether, you know, it was misrepresented, misquoted, was inappropriate, to say the least, and pushes us back several steps. For a community that's already living with so much Islamophobia on the rise, with so much attacks and discrimination, for our Prime Minister to utter such comments really does repulse many of us to the core, and I think it should.
Yes, and this is an issue that you have a lot of experience with as an organizer in Hamilton, someone from the Muslim community, someone who has been part of efforts to put together all sorts of diverse groups in Hamilton to fight against discrimination so that we're not hiding from racism, whether it comes from our government or from individuals within the city. And I know you mentioned the amount of activism that's happening today in Hamilton, the number of people that are getting involved, and that's a significant development. Generation Y, people born since the 80s, have been much more engaged than we've come to expect in the last few years over issues like the war on terror, over fighting discrimination, over the laws that some countries are coming up with in terms of hijabs and so on, and what's happening
Absolutely.
In Quebec. So, I mean, there's all sorts of involvement, and it's together with previously established groups, the movements from the baby boomers and so on. After 2001 and September 11 happened, there was two general responses that came out of Canada to that incident. And the first, there was the positive and negative trend. And in terms of the negative trend, it's something we've looked at in this program briefly before. And that is, for example, the torching, the burning of the Hindu Samaj temple.
Yeah.
That put us on the map, Hamilton, as a city where these kind of incidents occur. So CNN, U.S. International News was looking at us in that context as a place where a Hindu temple gets burned down. And of course, in that same span of time, mosques were vandalized,
Absolutely.
Attacked. So that was a very negative response, but the community banded together. And it's important right now, given what Harper's doing, to remember that the community banded together and said, no, we're not going to be intimidated. We're not going to let ethnic groups and religious groups and others in Canada be attacked.
Yeah.
There was a rebuilding of that Hindu Samaj. Yeah. In 2005, it was unveiled. There was federal support. There was a grassroots organization to make that happen. So with the community coming together and lobbying and putting pressure and getting help from the government, that was able to reverse some of the negative developments that had happened.
For
so,
sure.
Yeah, we've always had this choice, I guess, in terms of our response in Canada. Since 2001 and since 9/11, can you tell us, have you been involved in some of these initiatives that are broadly meant to combat racism and discrimination?
For sure. I mean, it's very interesting for me to speak about the 9/11 experience because, as you may or may not know, I was actually in Pakistan at the time. So this is my sixth year back. I was born here, but then lived in Pakistan for several years. When I was about six, I left and came back at 16, 17. So when 9/11 happened, giving my age away a bit, I guess, when 9/11 happened, I was in Pakistan at the time. And so when I discussed the phenomena, the experience with my peers and with my family, since my family lived in Canada for, you know, 30 plus years, so would they relay the story versus what it was over there, it's a very different narrative. I mean, there was fear, intimidation, but it was a different kind. Are they going to bomb us? Are we going to, you know, that was a different kind. Here, it formed a whole nother subculture, a new way of looking at Islam and religion. It had a very strong impact. It's hard to look at things this way, but sometimes as an activist, I think it's important for us to look at, you know, positives as well as negatives from any event. And pre 9/11, if we were to go back a bit, you know, our societies were very, you know, there was racism, there was discrimination, and it was on a rise. Actually, some Arab journals will document it. In North America, Islamophobia was on a rise 4 years prior to the 9/11 incident. So Islamophobia was already on a rise. It wasn't a phenomena that begins post 9/11 or at 9/11 period. We have to understand that and be sensitive to this fact. However, at the time, there was no real mobilization. Anti-war groups were not, the Muslim community wasn't maybe as involved as they are post 9/11. You know, those that were reached a certain comfortable income were complacent. They were happy with where they were and they didn't want to cause too much ruckus. They were the first generation of immigrants and they were happy to have made it and they thought that's enough. You know, and then some of the problems within our community, you know, that were arising, we didn't address them. We didn't feel that we needed to bring them up. Everything was okay so long as you had your own, you know, fort secured, your own house secured. And as for interfaith dialogue, that too, I mean, it happened, but not at the scale post 9/11. We didn't really feel the need to mobilize, if you will. And it was just very slow moving. 9/11 happens, and then we have this phenomena that changes the entire world, and especially North America, and the way Muslims are perceived, both intra, within our group of Muslims, the way we view each other, and the way the rest of the world, if you will, viewed the non-Muslims viewed Muslims. And it was a very scary time, and it still remains a very scary time with bills being passed in Quebec, that they want to, you know, ban hijab or ban niqab, to, as you said, the Hindu Samaj being burned down, just shows you the amount of ignorance that occurred at the time. People just weren't aware of Muslims and Islam as much as they are post 9/11. So if I am to talk about some of the positive, as I like to see positive in every part of the story, we are much more mobilized now. People know about us now. Maybe the media's version, the spin doctor version, but, you know, it's still out there. It's easier to start that conversation. It's on the radar. People know where certain countries are. They're not as far away anymore. They're not as foreign. But yeah, Islam was looked at something that was this threat to the West, and it was something that was coming to destroy Western civilization. And Muslims and many social activist groups really had to group together.
Yes.
And we had to strengthen our groups and come together and say, you know, today it's us, tomorrow it will be someone else. So what happened, if we're particular to Hamilton, is that the Hindu groups, Muslim groups, Christian groups, you know, even Jewish groups, we had the Hamilton Dialogue group form after that. We had the Hindu Samaj form an entire group as well. many multi-faith groups coming together and celebrating our diversity, having dialogues in which we talk about our differences as well as recognize the similarities that are universal within us, come to know the other, come to form stronger relations because we need each other when these situations happen. Because at the end of the day, those of us that, at least to the Western, the way that the media portrays Western civilization, anyone who appears foreign to that can come under attack. So it is not new or a phenomenon that only affects the Muslim community. And
yes,
I think that's important to remember.
Exactly. That's exactly it. The fear that happened after 9/11 in the community. It turns out that if we wanted to survive as a community, we being Muslims, Christians, Jewish people, people of all religions, had to come together and say no to any racism, because once you start dividing the society, you're breaking up that community.
And we had to uphold these principles that we believe in, the principles of innocent until proven guilty, because it seemed as though guilty until proven innocent became the motto of some of our justice system, the way that the media was portraying things. So certain laws that at the time of 9/11 were just passed unanimously, like the Anti-Terrorism Act, in which, you know, suspects could be arrested for 3 days if suspected for terror, and the law, another one being a clause that judges could compel witnesses to testify under duress or penalty of jail if they didn't testify, which before was an option. In 2007, these clauses expired. And many of us vowed never again, never again in the name of safety and security will we give away the fundamental rights that make us, that comprise us as Canadians, that we have to understand within reason. We have to understand due justice, due course of the law. And never again will we allow these blanket, you know, fear to overcome our senses and just allow for these very dangerous laws to pass and take away our fundamental freedoms.
Yes.
And what's dangerous about Prime Minister Harper, not only is he uttering these comments about Islamicism, but he has vowed to bring back these two clauses.
Yes.
So we as Canadians have to understand that there's a new wave of discrimination, not just Islamophobia. I like to say it's broader than that, but definitely Islamophobia, but many kinds of discrimination that are on the rise. And we have to be very wary of all this.
Yes, blaming the weak for problems in society. Yes. That is a trend that we're seeing. And you're right, citizens after 9/11 had to force the government to uphold the rule of law, the values that Canada is supposed to have, our rights and freedoms and
Absolutely.
So on. Citizens at the community level and so on had to actually organize to make the government do what it is supposed to do, and that is protect Canadians. And you're kind of referring to the other response to 9/11 that I was hinting at, which is the sort of George Bush response to 9/11.
Absolutely.
The response of fear and blaming and demonizing the Samuel Huntington clash of civilizations. We, the West, are at war with Muslims. I mean, we all saw the results of that and where it led. We are now in Iraq still. We're in Afghanistan. There's more wars all over the Middle East, drones everywhere. People are unhappy with that. They want the troops to come home, especially if you poll Americans and Canadians. But that's the agenda we got with George Bush, and we don't want that again. And then Harper comes along, and as you say, he's trying to reinstate this.
Absolutely. Things that were expired in 2007, we're seeing them back again, and God knows what more. I mean, this is not the end, and it certainly will not be the end if groups and people in general do not wake up and mobilize and stand up against this, because, as you say, we have witnessed what it did. And
yes,
we've seen several people just arrested, people that are gone missing. We never heard what happened to them.
Yes.
There was no way of accountability, no transparency of the law. Things that generations before were fought for, values that we strive for, all of a sudden, in the blink of an eye, we could give up just like that. Questioning was gone. And if we even bring it back home, you know, at McMaster community level, you know, within Hamilton, or even institutions in general, where dialogue and discourse was supposed to be the mandate of the day, that's what people came to universities for, you know, certain topics were just taboo.
Yes.
Especially when it comes to 9/11, you cannot discuss them. You do not discuss them, and it's not a free, safe place. You know, I believe that university should be a physically safe place. I do believe that academically, intellectually speaking, I don't think so. I think intellectually speaking, it shouldn't be just a safe, complacent place. It should be a very exciting place.
A place where things
ideas.
Happened, where ideas
Absolutely.
Are challenged. And
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what we have to do, because if we just sit there, we continue to get the security agenda, which is putting people into prison, which is putting GPS in people's cars, secret detention.
Exactly.
You know, it gets into one of the really big problems that we're seeing a parallel between Harper and Bush on, and that is in terms of protection. They say they're protecting us from terrorists and protecting us from Muslims. But
and who's going to protect us from them is the question that we need to be asking. Who is going to protect us from them and their crazy, tyrannical laws that they're trying to implement?
And also the depredations of our own society. Because if I look at the problems that are affecting me as a student, I see skyrocketing tuition, inflation. It's three
times.
Absolutely. We're all going into debt. Then there's this general sense of insecurity with the economy. People can lose their job. There's 20% unemployment if you look at the actual figures.
Yeah.
And then there's financial speculation driving up commodity prices, your gas price, your food price, all of those important things. There's an interview going around Facebook. You might have seen this. That's a British TV broadcaster is interviewing a financial professional. You know what that guy said. He said, if people that are involved in high finance don't have loyalty to a country, just money. And so what people should just be in it for themselves and not worry about the larger damage to the economy, just take what you can get. And there's a sort of financial terrorism being perpetrated on the people of Canada, of the United States, and all over the world. And all of these things are happening together, but we're not being protected from that. If you talk to the Republicans in the United States, they say you shouldn't have health care or job security or anything like that. So they don't want to protect your health or your job. But they say they are going to protect us from terrorists. And that's why we get Harper and his comment about Islamicism. I think that's a Bushism when you think about it.
Exactly. And it really sends a message home to a striking parallel between where Canada is moving, where foreign policy is moving, and what does Canada really stand for? Is it really that country that was once considered the peacekeeping nation, you know, the peaceful country where Canada was the balance, you know, neutral nation? Where are we moving? We really need to ask ourselves that question. And all I can say is we need to wake up. We really need to wake up. It's high time, over time, that the people come to terms with the fact that it's not going to become safer if we let these lunatics that we call our leaders run wide and pass these laws and make these comments and allow them to represent us abroad and locally.
Well, waking up is a big problem. That's where you need the media to help you, the journalistic institutions with newspapers and televisions. But that's a difficult uphill struggle. We have unusual sources here in CFMU, and we're going to play some promos later about how important it is to have local community radio. But it is very difficult to get your voice out. The Wall Street protests were mostly ignored, even though people were camping out there, and there was some police brutality, which finally is starting to get mentioned. So you're in a sort of black hole if you're trying to get information about all of these things surrounding us. In terms of issues related to Muslims, Islamophobia, issues that are of concern to the entire international community, such as Palestine, it can be very difficult to discuss these. I know you have been on the front lines of the media discussion. You have been an expert who engages with media, who holds conferences and think tanks and workshops, and looks at how people can have their views best represented as a member of the community. And you've been called upon to give commentary or opinion or feedback on several issues, sometimes about what's happening in the community with Muslims, sometimes about Palestine itself. And that's where things have gotten tricky. And I know there's been a lot of work to get fair representation in the media. And certainly, it can be difficult. You had been interviewed recently in the Spectator.
It was horrendous. I'm sorry. I'm just going to be very blunt. It was horrible. We had a Spectator reporter, had asked me, would you be willing to? We have one person giving the, she called it, the opposition side of, as we know, to give some context, the Palestine bid for UN bid for statehood was placed last Friday, and Mahmoud Abbas went before the United Nations to request statehood for Palestine, something that, again, is high time, overdue, as I call it, not just high time. And I was asked to help give some perspective on the Palestinian side, as they would call it, or the pro-Palestinian side. I like to say the pro-justice side, to be honest with you, and to balance the article. And I thought, I've seen how these things work in the past, but if we say no, we're damned. If we say yes, we're damned. So I said, okay, I will go on and answer her questions. And I was very offended because the entire article was about the pro-Israeli person who was spreading his reasons why Palestine doesn't deserve a state and why these are, unilateral negotiations and whatnot. And then it went on to the foreign defense minister of Israel, and it went on further to the prime minister, and then the picture of the one person who was speaking, and I was the last two lines. One of which was saying that Anissa Mirza supports every state and every individual's right to state. And I thought to myself,
right,
sound crazy.
So what was published in words and written text was that you supported the right of individual people, like individual persons,
to become
a state. So I could become a state.
You could become a state. We could fight a state, Brendan, basically, is what I was saying. And I thought, this is just crazy.
Because that's not what you said.
No, it is not what I said. What I said is that according to the United Nations, under Article 4 of the United Nations, every member of the UN is allowed under the UN Charter to have the right of recognition, to request recognition of statehood. And there are four principal guidelines that they have to follow in order to attain that. And really quickly, I told her that they're a permanent. They have to have a permanent population, one; two, a defined territory; three, a government; four, independence and ability to interact with other nations. And Palestine has demonstrated all four of these criteria. According to the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and European Union, they've stated that Palestinian institutions are developed at a level appropriate to statehood. As far as I told her, the only thing that people could argue is the argument that the territory, Palestine does not have a defined territory. But I said, let us not forget that Israel also did not have a defined territory and found itself becoming a state under the United Nations. So that clause there does not apply,
right,
if we want to make that argument here. And, you know, much more was discussed, but what was quoted was this, and I was offended. But it didn't end there, apparently, because the arrogance from the pro-Israeli side is just so high and so flaming these days that, you know, I had someone then write a response against the few comments that were, I don't even think they're worthy of responding to if I actually had said those. But
so you mean the one sentence you were given?
The one
literally, it was one sentence.
The one sentence I was given that was chopped into three lines to make three paragraphs out of the one yeah, that one. So what I was told is Anissa Mirza is a liar and is only giving part of the truth, and that, you know, Palestinians and apologists, apparently I'm
an
apologist.
Wait. So in the one sentence you were quoted on,
yeah,
you were accused of only giving part of the truth.
I was I was giving only part of the truth, and that too, I was lying in it. I wasn't giving the full truth. I was concealing it. What basically, you know, we Palestinians and Palestinian apologists do not deserve a state. So basically,
that's,
I think he was
saying,
going with the line of individuals deserving states. Palestinian states does not deserve to be a state until they can be willing to consume and resume to those unilateral negotiations and get back to the Oslo Accord.
Right.
Of course, we know that for the several decades this has hit an impasse. How many more individuals have to die? How many more people have to suffer? How much more destruction until Israel and its friends, aka the U.S. and Canada, will believe that enough has happened on the negotiation side? We need to give these people the basic dignity that any nation would require, the basic individual human rights that every state's peoples should have. And it's absolutely disgusting and appalling that our prime minister also supports the Israeli government and these negotiations to the T. Like, he's willing to go as far as it takes to support this, and he's vowed openly on CBC again.
Yeah. Harper has said he's Israel's best friend, in a sense, in almost those words. And your position that you're advocating to The Spectator seems to be that represented by the international community as a whole, by the United Nations, if you look at voting procedures and so on. But I think what we're getting at here is that The Spectator was very good at showing the pro-Israeli government side of the argument, but you're attempt to get representation was more difficult.
What's very important to remember, Brendan, is that they also like to sometimes represent us, even for that one sentence, because what they can turn around and say on paper is, we have balanced journalism. We got both perspectives. Mm-hmm. We spoke with both sides, and now allow the public to make their decision. Well, no, this is not balanced journalism, and if you really wanted to write an article on Israel and why the pro-Israeli side is correct, then you should not have recorded and interviewed another person.
Although in this case, I think you can give yourself some more credit, because you've done a good job here personally and some of the community organizations, because what's happened here, The Spectator has made some effort to provide balance in the coverage, and perhaps it's not as full-hearted as we would like, but what in the past you would have the pro-Israeli government position reported as news.
Absolutely.
Or you would have their position reported and then they would go to no one. But now, because of discussions and community engagement by organizations, including ones that you've participated in, there's been talks with The Spectator and other newspapers to ensure that there should be attempts to better represent both sides of the issue. And they made a step towards doing so when they spoke with you. It just wasn't executed very well. I mean, there could have been more effort, and it could have been taken a bit more seriously by The Spectator.
Absolutely.
But you see, this is a place where the media has gone perhaps halfway in the right direction because of community activism. And so I think it encourages further engagement and looking at how the two sides can be represented in a truly balanced fashion. I know we know how there's bias evident thanks to films like Peace, Propaganda, and The Promised Land, which you can find on the internet.
Yes,
I believe.
Yeah.
So you were quite represented properly, but a test is coming up for The Spectator, and that is next week, because there's a series of events that are important events. And
yeah,
now, and there's going to be a question, can The Spectator represent these events? Can the local media engage with these popular events? And you are actually involved in some of them, including a workshop. Can you tell us about that workshop?
Yeah, I'd love to. As you mentioned, as you're alluding to, Mac, Peace Week is coming up, and at larger, the Gandhi Peace Festival, and people are organizing all types of events across many campuses, and McMaster is also chipping in on those activities, and we have actually a full week of events lined up, very exciting. The one on Wednesday, October 5th, begins at 6:30 p.m. and hosted by the group that I mentor currently, Senior Advisor to McMaster Muslims for Peace and Justice.
Wait, did you say that was Tuesday?
Wednesday, October 5th. And it's called 9/11 Then and Now. And it'll be reflections on the changes that have happened at the foreign policy level, at the community level, at the interfaith level, at the political level, pre and post 9/11. And so it's going to be very interesting. And basically, it's a teach-in. What's very important to understand is it's not your typical lecture. I mean, lectures are important, but many people, youth, academics, community at large that come out say we're not giving them a forum to really discuss, to really share ideas, to really voice opinions. And so we wanted to go back to that kind of very traditional concept of a teach-in. And so the concept will be we have four different speakers coming in, academics speaking on areas of their own expertise relating to the 9/11 phenomena at large. And again, it's not just dealing with Islamophobia, but 9/11 as a total, what it has done to our society in North America and at the international level. And we're going to have four to five different academics coming in to speak. And then after that, they speak for about an hour, each of them for about 10 to 12 minutes each. But what's very exciting is after that, the groups, we break into four groups, and each person is assigned to a group that deals with a particular subtopic that was discussed that day. And the academic speaker then act as facilitators to that group, so people are allowed to have a back and forth conversation. There's a full hour provided for that. So if you're into conversation, if you really want to engage with the subject material, you want to voice your opinion, hear other people's opinions, we really encourage you to come out on Wednesday, October 5th. Again, that's 6:30 p.m. and the room is Council Chambers, Gilmore Hall, 111. So Council Chambers and Gilmore Hall.
And this is open to the public.
Absolutely, we encourage the public to come out. The students, the academics, faculty, family members. It's open to everyone, and that's the main aim of it being a teach-in, is that we can get all a multi-perspective, multifaceted approach where people don't have to walk away saying, we only got to hear, not to engage, and we don't know what next steps to take. You know, even if you disagree with the views of the speakers that will be presented, we even more so encourage you to come out, voice those opinions. This will be your chance to have that one-hour conversation, so don't say we didn't give you that chance. But beyond that, we have a bunch of other things lined up for the week. On October 3rd, we have Richard Falk coming down at 7:30 p.m. to speak in MDCL room 1105 on the topic of towards a nonviolent geopolitics. And then his wife on October 4th speaks, Dr. Hilal Elver, on a very relevant topic that was discussed today, reflections on Islamophobia in North America. And that will actually be off campus, not at McMaster University, at West Hill High School, again, 7:30 p.m. Then once again, Wednesday, October 5th is MMPJ's teach-in on 9/11. But Thursday, October 6th is yet again a very important, influential speaker coming down. Amira Haas, a journalist of Israel to the Haaretz, is coming down to speak about the Middle East and Israel-Palestine conflict and the fear surrounding it. So we're very excited. Tickets are on sale and they will be sold throughout Mac Peace Week at all the events. You can contact MMPJ or SJME members who will be selling the tickets. $10 for students, $15 to community members.
Okay, wonderful. This is also something that I'm going to read out later on in the program today in case you missed it, the details of the four or so events happening and where you can be. This is all open to the public, including the event at Westdale.
Absolutely.
So everyone can come there at 7:30 on that day. Okay, that's great. So there's a lot of ground we've covered today. We need a response, a community response to Harper's Islamophobia. No one wants to see George Bush 2 or George Bush 3 or whatever. And on the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War website, there's a statement about the community coming together to protest against this, and there will be especially the dedicated workshops and other events coming up next week, which people should attend, also listed on that website. So, Anissa, thanks so much for actually physically coming here, being here.
It was my pleasure.
It avoided a lot of craziness for our listeners, so thanks so much for that.
Thank you for having me once again.
We're going to take a musical break, and when I come back, we'll talk a bit more about these events.